So again, in this session, we're going back to the preliminaries, the foundation practices. And we saw there at the beginning of that section that the entry point and central pillar for this Mahamudra practice, the Mahayana in general, of course, is to go for refuge and... No, we don't need the lights on. It's okay. To go for refuge and to generate bodhicitta as the entry point and support for the practice. And we also saw that in the shamatha practice, as the part of the preparation for that practice at the beginning of the meditation, also to cultivate a pure mind, a virtuous pure mind, by going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. And we saw also there, as part of the preparation, then we looked at this seven-limb prayer, to go through this seven-limb prayer to prepare ourselves. And then also, as part of that, to visualize our teacher in front of us, to make some requests for them to inspire and guide us, and then to absorb them into ourselves. So there we saw a number of steps in this prayers for meditation to help prepare us for a meditation. So what I'd like to do in this meditation session is to sort of go through these steps quite slowly, so that actually more or less the whole meditation is this preparation, so that we can at least get familiar with some of the steps that we can go through. So I'd like to do that as the meditation today in the preliminary practices session. I mean, of course, you don't need to read this at all. I'll be guiding you through it. So it's better to just do a proper meditation, and I'll guide you through the various steps. So, of course, as normal, we'll begin by preparing ourselves well, and then I will sort of step us through these points, and we can reflect on the various points just to get a little bit familiar with the different elements. Okay? So find a nice, comfortable posture. We begin, as always, by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. and allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And as the text says, we can begin with a virtuous and pure mind by going for refuge and generating bodhicitta. But as the Panchen Lama says, to not do these is merely words from our mouth. So to help make them meaningful, we can first begin by reflecting on the four thoughts. The four thoughts that turn the mind toward practice. So we can reflect on each of these four thoughts very briefly. And the first thought is, this precious life of leisure and opportunity is rare and easily lost. The world and those within it are impermanent. I too will die soon. The results of my virtuous and non-virtuous actions will without fail ripen within me. And there is no genuine happiness to be found within the abodes of samsara. Therefore, I must correctly practice the true Dharma. So now we can go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By my practice of giving in other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And to help support that aspiration of bodhicitta, we can briefly reflect on each of the four immeasurables. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. And may they abide in equanimity, free from attachment and aversion to those near and far. So now we can imagine our teacher meditating with us. Imagine them in front of us. And if you don't have a personal teacher, then just think of someone who you respect highly and admire. Someone who inspires you. Imagine they're meditating with you, they're in front of you. And then we can go through this seven-limb prayer to uplift the mind. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. So mentally bow down to all the wonderful qualities that this person in front of you has, qualities that you would like to cultivate. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So make an offering to them. The highest offering you can give them is to offer them your practice. To follow their advice. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. So bring to mind some action, a non-virtuous action that you've done recently, and openly declare this to the person in front of you. Developing sincere regret for having done that thing. And I rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. So bring to mind a virtuous action that you've done very recently. And rejoice in that. Be happy about having done that. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. So make a request to the person in front of you that they continue to guide you and continue to stay in your life and guide you and help you in the spiritual path. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great enlightenment. And then make a request to the person in front of you, the teacher, inspirational person. Ask them to help inspire and guide you in your Mahamudra practice. And then imagine that they've heard your request and they're very happy to do so. And then imagine they rise up to the top of your head. They dissolve into white light. And this comes down and merges with your own Buddha nature, your own inner wisdom at your heart. They are there with you, inspiring and guiding you. And then with your eyes at least partially open, bring your attention to your own mind. And attentively focus on the clear and knowing nature of the mind. And observe your mind single-pointedly and nakedly with bare attention. And whenever any thought arises, simply recognize it. Observe it as it arises and passes, without grasping to it, without becoming distracted. then in conclusion, we can dedicate the positive potential that we've gathered through doing this meditation. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the enlightened state and lead all sentient beings without exception into that state of enlightenment. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. And may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Anyone have any questions about those steps, any of those steps? Maybe we can turn the light on now, by the way. Yeah. About
Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What is Sangha?
Sangha. Yes, I mean, Sangha, of course, we can understand at many levels. I mean, what's called the ultimate Sangha, the Sangha that, of course, can be of most benefit to us, is anyone who has had a direct realization of emptiness. So that's sort of the best case scenario. But, of course, Sangha here, in a very general way, can mean anyone who supports us in the spiritual path. So it depends on what level. I mean, the Sangha jewel technically is that level of Sangha who's had a direct realization of emptiness because they can best help us in the spiritual path.
What practically would that mean? For live people, could you give an example of those who have direct realization of emptiness?
Yes, I've got a list here, I'll show you. It's a secret list, but I'll show you. I'll let you know because you asked. I was keeping it to myself. As I think briefly mentioned already once earlier, is that, you know, people who've had direct realization of emptiness normally don't go around in public sort of telling people. Because again, one of the signs of progress in the spiritual path is humility. So often people who have actually realized emptiness are even more humble than the average person. And if you ask them, they'll say, well, you know, I can't even meditate very well. I can't be a, you know, I don't know, sort of thing, you know. So how can we know if someone's directly realized emptiness? Well, one thing we can do is look at their behavior. Because if they've realized emptiness directly, it means they've started to eliminate ignorance and mental afflictions. So this person should be have very pure ethics. And also, because of starting to eliminate ignorance, they means that they have realized the interconnected nature of everything directly. They should have very high level of loving kindness and compassion for others. So this, through their behavior, that can be an indication. So if someone is being unethical and doesn't really have loving kindness and compassion, that's a pretty sure bet that they haven't realized emptiness directly. And also, of course, if they're explaining emptiness, then they should be able to explain it in a way that not only is clear, but somehow that it connects with you. So you can also listen to their explanation on emptiness to get some indication. But of course, the reality is to know for sure, it's very difficult. It's said, though, that once we have a direct realization of emptiness, due to the purity of our mind, we will be able to directly see the minds of others. So from the point when we first realize emptiness directly onwards, if someone is at our level or lower, we know exactly where they are. If someone's a little bit higher, we know they're higher, but not how high. So the only way to really know is if we've directly realized emptiness, we can see their mind. We know. We know. And of course, another thing we can do is if it is a teacher within a respected tradition and you're not sure about them or not, you can ask some highly regarded other teacher within that tradition what their opinion is of that person. So that can also be a way of checking them out. Therefore, if a teacher is not within a larger organization and they're on their own, which often you find because people, if they're highly qualified, they often have their own style of teaching, which often maybe doesn't really fit within a particular organization's structure. So often you do find highly qualified teachers sort of going on their own. But the thing is then, if they're on their own, then we need to be even more stringent in our way of checking them out. Whereas if they're in an organization, then we have means of checking them out more easily. Where if they're sort of on their own, they do their own thing, then we have to be even more stringent in how we check them out before accepting them as a teacher. That's very important. Okay. Right, let's now go back into the preliminary practices. And now I'd like to go into these, what's here we saw on page one, in the middle, the four guiding instructions. So we saw in terms of preliminaries that even as a preliminary to refuge and bodhicitta, we have these four thoughts, the four thoughts that turn the mind. And they are often called the four common preliminaries because they're in common to all levels of Mahayana practice. As a basis for any sort of Mahayana practice, we have those four thoughts. They're called the four common preliminaries. So we saw there the first one was precious human life, to reflect on the precious opportunity we have now. To reflect on the fact that that's not going to last forever, so death and impermanence. The third one, of course, was to reflect on karma, the law of cause and effect in terms of our behaviour. And the fourth point was to reflect on the unsatisfactory nature of samsara, or in other words, the Sanskrit word, the word there, of course, is dukkha. This is the first noble truth. So those of you who have studied the Lam Rim, of course, can understand that these are one of the first four reflections within the Lam Rim as a basis for the other Lam Rim practices. So these are preliminaries or foundation practices that are in common to all Mahayana practices. Here, these four guiding instructions are called the four uncommon preliminaries. Because these are preliminaries to the tantra level of practice. And here in particular we're talking about Mahamudra, tantra level of Mahamudra practice. And so here we see going for refuge, generating bodhicitta, Vajrasattva meditation, mandala offering, and guru yoga. Now, each one of those serves a purpose. And again, they are preliminaries to tantra level of practice. But also, we can have an equivalent practice that is a preliminary for the sutra level of practice. So I want to sort of make that more clear, because here we're only looking at the preliminaries for the tantra level of practice. The first, going for refuge in generating bodhicitta, we saw there already that that was the door of entry and the support. Remember the central pillar. So refuge in bodhicitta is the entry and support for practice. So the first of the preliminaries is to give us a door of entry and a support for the practice. So remember, these are the preliminaries for the tantra level of practice. And any of you who have done these practices here as part of preparation for tantra, when we do the refuge, remember we have refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha, often at this level, if anyone's done these preliminary practices, often in the refuge, not only do we take refuge to Buddha Dharma Sangha, but we take refuge in what's called the three roots. Because what is the root of the practice is the guru, the teacher. And in tantric practice, we're practicing usually a particular deity, a particular enlightened form. So that's what's called our personal meditation deity. You know, usually we introduce that with the teacher. They'll based on our type of character, they'd say, okay, I think for you, the best would be for you to practice Tara, or Chenrezig, or Yamantaka, or Vajrayogini, depending on the type of person we are. So that is also what we go for refuge, because that's the deity we're practicing. That's called the Yidam. And then also here, at this level of practice, we can rely on high-level other beings who may not be human to support us in our practice, often called the Dharma protectors. And in the Nyingma school, here, often instead of Dharma protectors, they talk about the Dakinis. So at the Tantra level of refuge and bodhicitta, refuge usually means going for refuge into Buddha Dharma Sangha and going for refuge to your guru, your personal deity, and these Dharma protectors or Dakinis. At the sutra level of practice, of course, we need entry and support. And Sutra Mahamudra, also, of course, the entry and support for Sutra Mahamudra is refuge in bodhicitta. But of course, here, refuge is simply Buddha Dharma Sangha.
So that's the first of the preliminaries, and the purpose here is to have an entry point and a support for the practice.
And then if we go over onto page 2, sort of a little bit down in the text here, there's a paragraph that starts, moreover. It says, moreover, since seeing the ultimate nature of the mind is dependent upon having accumulated the collections and purified the obscurations, then we need to do some things. So, therefore, in general, as a preliminary or foundation for any Mahayana practice, we need to purify our mind of negativities and we need to accumulate virtue. So this is very common as a foundation for all practices. We do what these two things, purification and accumulation. So how do we purify our mind of obscurations and negativity? Here at the tantra level, the practice we do for purification as a foundation is Vajrasattva meditation. And so we go through this practice, and of course Vajrasattva is a particular tantric deity. So, of course, this practice has a very tantric flavour. It involves visualising Vajrasattva and all sorts of light and purification and chanting mantra and so forth. So this is very tantric flavour practice because it's a basis of tantra. But, of course, also purification and accumulating virtue, these two things are also necessary at the sutra level of Mahamudra practice. So what can we do here to purify the mind of negativities? We can engage in what's called the four opponent powers. And these are four things we can do to purify the mind of obscuration and negativity. So to briefly mention them, the first thing is regret. Meaning if we've done some harmful, non-virtuous behaviour, if we may have sincere regret for having done that harmful thing, that is already starting to purify the mind of those imprints and negative habits. Then, the second of the four opponent powers is reliance, or sometimes called foundation, and that is to reaffirm the positive direction that we want to follow in our life. And here, of course, in sutra level Mahayana, the direction we're following is we are relying on refuge and bodhicitta. So usually here, it is to reaffirm refuge and bodhicitta. And that reaffirming that positive direction in life also works against any negative habits, negative imprints. The third of the four powers is remedy, is to think of some practical remedy to overcome that negative behaviour. So, of course, here we can be very practical. and do something positive opposite to the negative behavior. You know, if we said something harsh to someone, a practical remedy can be to apologize.
All negative, the sort of ultimate remedy here is, of course, emptiness. Because all negative behavior is based on ignorance. So if we, as part of our long-term remedy, we work on the wisdom of emptiness, that will start to also weaken negative actions. But in the short term, we can do practical, positive, opposite behavior. And the fourth is resolve. Make a strong determination not to do that negative behavior again. Now, of course, if that negative behavior is some strong habit that we do a lot often, there's no point in saying, I'm never going to do it again. It's just not going to happen. Rather, if it's a strong habit, set a time limit and say, for the next day, I'm not going to do that. If that's way too difficult, the next hour, I'm not going to do that thing. Pick an amount of time that, with some effort, normally you can manage, and then over time you can extend it from 1 hour to 2 hours to a day, a week, a month, the rest of our life. So if we engage in these four opponent powers with respect to any negative behavior, we can purify the mind of negativities and negative imprints. So this is how we can work with purification at the level of the sutra. These four opponent powers, of course, are packaged within Vajrasattva practice. These four elements are within Vajrasattva. But of course, the way they're packaged involves visualizing a deity, chanting a mantra, and so forth. So this is purification. Any questions so far? Yeah.
What are impurities? For example, is...
What
are impurities of the mind?
Impurities?
Yeah, for example, if a sadness is an impurity or not.
Again, it depends how you define the word sadness. But in general, sadness is very positive, so it's not an impurity. But often our sadness is polluted with mental afflictions, particularly attachment and aversion. So what happens is our sadness degenerates into grief, despair, and depression. And then someone who's died recently, sadness is a healthy thing, but then 5 years later, we're still in depressive state because they've left us behind. This is not sadness. This is pollution by mental afflictions. So the goal of Buddhist practice is not, if someone passes away, to remain blank and go, that didn't affect me. This would be very unhealthy. So of course, if someone passes away or leaves, sadness is genuine. Sadness is good. And genuine sadness has a little bit of a sweetness to it. It also can appreciate the fact that we've managed to have time with that person, and then we can move on. But sadness that's polluted by mental afflictions often degenerates into grief, despair, and depression. And in extreme cases, the person hates the other person because they left them behind. I mean, that's tragic, but that's mental afflictions. No, well, deep sadness is nothing wrong with deep sadness. So we're not purifying sadness. We're purifying the mental afflictions which corrupt sadness.
But if you feel
we're not trying to get rid of sadness.
But if you feel yourself so sad day after day, what you just...
Well, then that sadness, that what's coming... There's two things then that are happening. There's sadness, and then something's polluting that sadness. And usually it's attachment or aversion. Usually it's attachment... Oh, I don't have that person anymore. I don't have that person anymore. Poor me, poor me, poor me. It's all focused on me, not them. Sadness is focused on them, not me. Yeah?
I have two questions. One is about the regret.
Regret. Yeah.
The regret one. It's very variable. What are you...
Very
variable.
variable.
What are you regret of? So basically, some regrets cause really high level of depression.
No, that's guilt.
Guilt.
Yeah. So here we need to be distinguished between regret and guilt. If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on? Yeah. What's the focus when we feel guilty? What are we focusing on when we feel guilty?
Yes.
Bad me. So guilt is coming from cognitive fusion. So it's a completely false perspective. We should never feel guilty about anything because it's completely useless. It's based on a false perspective, an invalid perspective, and all it does is it paralyzes us, makes us feel bad, and causes us to go into depression. Completely useless. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything. And unfortunately, it seems that this has been used over the centuries to have power over people. Because if you can make someone feel guilty, you can control them, you can have power over them. So not healthy. Whereas regret, if we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we focusing on when we regret? The behavior. So this is based on the correct perspective. I have done that harmful behavior. And through regret, then, we can address that bad behavior and work to overcome it. And we can still feel good about ourselves. We can have compassion and forgiveness for ourselves. But with this, impossible. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve forgiveness. I'm a bad person.
And another question as well. That is regarding the three rules. You mentioned about Dakini, the Dharma protectors.
Yeah.
Can you open that up a little bit? So that can be a wider search.
The wider, what's
yeah,
it?
I want to search it by myself. So.
Yeah, so again, if you look within particularly Mahamudra and Dzogchen, when they talk about refuge, mm-hmm. then you'll find it all mentioned there in that context. In the Lam Rim, which is based on this, when they come to refuge, of course, there's no mention of this. Because this is tantra.
Are they kind of deities?
Deities. They are. No, deity here, it means like someone who's enlightened being. Dharma protectors normally are not enlightened, but they're a high level practitioner. Maybe not in human form.
Okay. So this is purification. Then the two things we need to do is purify the mind of negativity and we need to increase the virtue of our mind. You know, often in the Tibetan society, and you see someone striving to do good things or striving for something and they're not really getting anywhere, often you'll hear the Tibetans go, they got no merit. They've got no merit. And what they mean is they haven't got this accumulation of virtue. Because we need a store of this positive potential to help drive us forward. So accumulation of virtue at the level of tantra here is through mandala offering. So mandala offering, again, is very tantric because a mandala is either a pictorial or, in this case, you have a disc and some things on it that symbolise a mandala, which is the world, enlightened world, the world according to an enlightened being. And so in this mandala offering, you are offering this symbolic representation of an enlightened world to usually your master, your teacher, your guru. So this is, doing this offering is generosity, of course, and that's accumulating virtue. So what can we do equivalent at the sutra level is of course the six perfections practices such as generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, and so forth. So these practices
particularly the first one, generosity, which is the most easy, is a good way to accumulate virtue.
And then the last point, jumping ahead a bit, because we'll finish that paragraph. So it said, since the ultimate nature of the mind is dependent upon having accumulated the collections and purified the obscurations, recite the 100-syllable mantra of Vajrasattva at least 100,000 times. So these four uncommon preliminaries are often presented in a way of doing each of those practices intensively 100,000 repetitions. And it says, and in addition, as an essential practice, earnestly confess negative actions and promise to refrain from doing them again by completing the four opponent powers. So there we saw the four opponent powers. Through practices such as making as many hundreds of prostrations as possible while reciting the admission of downfalls. So the admission of downfalls is another text, sometimes called the 35 Buddhas prostration text, where we do a similar thing as Vajrasattva, incorporating the four opponent powers to purify the mind. And then in the commentary here, there's no mention of the mandala offering. There's no extra commentary on it. But that is the accumulation of virtue. And then the last paragraph here, which we're going to look again at tomorrow, it says, then from the depths of your heart, make repeated requests to your root guru, and so on. So here we're talking about what's called guru yoga. And what is the purpose of this is to receive inspiration and to plant the seed of wisdom. Is by doing this guru yoga practice, we will receive inspiration. But at this level, the tantra level of practice, the guru yoga practice is designed to actually plant the seed of wisdom in our mind. What is the equivalent of that at the sutra level is, as we saw a little bit in the text here, to make requests to the teacher, to the guru. So again, at what we did in that previous meditation in this session, at the beginning there, we made those requests that not only for the teacher to continue to guide us in our life, but to guide us in this practice and help support and guide us in this practice. So that, of course, and then as part of that, we're dissolving the teacher into ourselves, and by that way, we would hopefully get a lot of inspiration that the teacher is there with us, guiding us and helping us. And then also at the more tantric level, also planting really already a seed of wisdom in our mind. So this is the four uncommon preliminaries, and I want to tomorrow look at this a little bit more because there's quite a few things to talk about here. But any questions on any of this before we break for tea? Yeah.
Can you do like preliminaries for Tantra and engage in Sutra?
Yes. Yeah. The thing is, though, of course, when we look at these practices here, these three in particular, they're tantric flavored practices. And thereby, for them to be most effective, assumes the basis, assumes renunciation, bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness. And so often, these are presented in many the different traditions of Tibetan Buddhism as one of the very first things to do. And then, of course, we don't have any renunciation, we don't have any bodhicitta, and we don't even can't even spell emptiness, let alone know what it is or have any experience of it. So then these practices lose a lot of their efficiency and power because of that. And sometimes these practices then can actually lead to more problems, because sometimes in these practices we're visualizing deities and so forth, and if we have a very strong self-grasping mind, that could increase. So therefore, ideally, these preliminaries should be done on the basis of some sort of renunciation, some sort of bodhicitta, some sort of experience of emptiness, ideally. Whereas these sorts of practices here, which are the equivalent practices, you don't need to have particularly a realization of emptiness as a basis to do those practices effectively. So you can do these in the initial part, but again, I think they lose a lot of the power because we don't have a good basis for them. So you could do them, and you could benefit from them as a very beginning practice, but they become even more powerful if we can establish a little bit of a basis to do these practices, if we can really work on some bodhicitta and some wisdom of emptiness. If we have those a little bit, and then we engage in these practices, 100,000 repetitions, then they can have much, much more impact than if we don't.
Yeah, but my question was, if you are engaging in
yeah.
practice, sure. anyway, you need to do it.
Yeah, so you can, like I said, you can... Exactly. Sure. You can engage in these practices now and then engage in Sutra Mahamudra, of course. Of course you can do that. But like I said, is that the danger is, if we do these too early, one is we often don't understand actually the practice, and two, they lose a lot of their power, because inbuilt in these practices is the idea that everything's coming out of emptiness. And of course, if we don't do that, then a lot of the power is lost. I mean, in, for example, the mandala offering, the accumulation of virtue, often we talk about here, the mandala offering, we talk about the two accumulations, merit and wisdom. But if we don't have a wisdom of emptiness, there's not really any accumulation of wisdom here at all. Whereas if we can do the mandala offering coming out of emptiness, very powerful, very powerful. Then we have accumulation of merit and wisdom. This is the best. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? So again, we're going to go into the Guru Yoga in more detail tomorrow.
You say realizing emptiness directly. What do you mean by that? Sometimes you use directly, sometimes
yeah,
not.
Yeah. We very briefly touched on it in the Tantra Mahamudra, and I'm going to, tomorrow we're doing the Vipassana, we're going to talk about that. But the brief answer is that now when we do Vipassana practice, and if we're trying to cultivate the wisdom of emptiness, and we come to realize there's no independent me here, then when we come to have that experience initially, there's a sense of me, the meditator, experiencing this emptiness. So there's a sense of subject-object duality. So that's a conceptual realization, well, not even realization, but a conceptual experience of emptiness. And so even when we come to realize emptiness, and to realize means based on shamatha, even when we come to realize initially, it's still a little bit conceptual. There's still a sense of me, the meditator, realizing this emptiness. And then as we're going to see tomorrow, or maybe even the next day, as that deepens, eventually that apparent duality will collapse. And then in the direct realization of emptiness, in the middle of that experience, there's no sense of a me. There's just the experience of emptiness. So if you're having some experience and you're thinking at that time, oh, I'm directly realizing emptiness, that's 100% proof that you're not, because it's impossible to have that thought at that time. Impossible. So if you're thinking, oh, I'm directly realizing anything, you're not. Proof.
So it's an experience, it's not actually...
Well, it's a realization, but it's a non-conceptual direct realization. Okay, let's break now, come back at 3:30, and we'll go back into our shamatha practice, and I'm hoping to finish the shamatha section of the text this afternoon.